This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm bringing you the show today from Edstone, England, in the middle of a few weeks of visiting our offices over here. Well, last Friday on our Week in Review program, we talked about explosive recent events on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Evidence is emerging that there is more to the story than we were aware of when we had that discussion. It looks like this hasn't just been spontaneous protests against Israel setting up security measures to prevent terrorist attacks. There is actually an outside power that has designs on Jerusalem that is orchestrating these events. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the evidence and these latest revelations, what they tell us about what's happening over in that very important strategic real estate. In our second segment, we're going to talk about the danger of nuclear terrorism. When the battle for the Iraqi city of Mosul was recently won against the terrorist group Islamic State, nuclear experts were really relieved. It turns out the Islamic State was sitting right on top of some material that it could have used to make a nuclear dirty bomb. Trumpet writer Anthony Chabadaway will tell us why those nuclear experts were so concerned and why we aren't completely out of the woods. The threat of nuclear terrorism is still very real, and it's really some quite stunning information that he's going to present to us. In our third segment today, we're going to go in a completely different direction. We're going to talk about artificial sweeteners. The hottest sweetener on the market right now is Splenda, or sucralose. It's been marketed as having no negative side effects. This is a way to have the sweetness that you crave, but none of the negative effects of sugar. We're going to talk about this substance with registered holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian and why we need to be skeptical about the claims that it has no negative side effects. And because I'm here in Edstone, I'm helping out with the Philadelphia Youth Camp over these couple of weeks. I'm going to finish the program today by sharing how my own experience in summer camp as a teen helped my relationship with my parents. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Recent events on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem have been something of a chess match, a strategic battle between Arabs and Israel vying for the upper hand. And as we talked about on the program last Friday, the Palestinians have done a tremendous job of turning these events against Israel. It started with Palestinian terrorists murdering Israeli police officers. It included three Israelis being murdered in their kitchen at home. And somehow Israel came out looking like the bad guy. People all over are talking like Israel is orchestrating these events to take over the Temple Mount. Well, is it just the Palestinians behind what's happening here, or is there more to the story? To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello, how are you?
Doing great. So we were talking about this last Friday and just about what a success the Arab propaganda has been against Israel. What more is there to this? If you're just looking at how perfectly this is kind of playing into their hands, can we look at this as just a success story by Palestinian propagandists?
Right. So it is a very interesting question, because normally when you have such a terrorist attack like this, the initial terrorist attack, there is always somebody that takes credit for it, especially something of this magnitude. You would want to show that you're leading the Palestinian rebellion against the state of Israel, that you're not willing to, abide by any of Israel's domination of the Temple Mount. So that was number one. The fact that nobody came out and really said, "We did it," was kind of odd, to show that there might be somebody else concealing if they're behind it or not. So that was really odd. And then it seems just the way the speed at which the protests took place, the fact that Israel was really just climbing down, walking back their security measures bit by bit, and yet every time the protesters, didn't yield. They were willing to continue until they got exactly what they want, until everything came down. Shows that there might have been a bit more to it than just people wanting to go back and pray on the Temple Mount without Israeli interference.
Right. All of this happening kind of spontaneously in response to Israel taking what really by any measure should be considered legitimate security measures in the face of a terrorist attack. This isn't just it's pretty implausible to look at this as just people spontaneously uprising and saying, well, we demand justice. We can never permit Israel to take these kinds of measures.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So looking at the whole sweep of it, and we're really just kind of picking up the discussion where we left off last Friday, why did Israel back down? The fact that the protests, that the murders of Israelis, that all of this essentially put Israel's government, the Netanyahu-led government, into enough of a corner that it felt like, okay, we're taking down the metal detectors and all other security on the Temple Mount. We're going to allow this to take place. Why did Israel do this?
Right. So even when we were talking on Friday, I said to you, it was kind of shocking for me to see that the Netanyahu government did this. Well, what's come out since that Friday, well, actually during that Friday, there was a story that broke that talked about the possible links of this attack, the initial attack, to Iran. And then we had Mr. Netanyahu, so that came out on Friday, and then Mr. Netanyahu had a statement on Sunday saying that, this is what he said on a cabinet meeting, he said, I'm attentive to the public sensitivities and understand their feelings, saying that he understands that you didn't want me to take down these security measures, you thought that they were good, Israeli mm-hmm. public, so do I. But then he says, but I, as the Prime Minister of Israel and the person who bears responsibility for Israel's security, I must make decisions calmly and dispassionately and with proper judgment. I do so with a broad perspective of the entire map and the threats facing us, and some of which are not known to the public. So He's hinting that there's something else going on here, and it was more important for me to take down these security measures to ensure that whatever somebody else wanted to happen, that it didn't get exacerbated to be an even bigger crisis than it is.
So Netanyahu, obviously, he has a certain reputation and a certain level of commands a certain level of respect because he is so strong in defending Israel against those who would attack it. And you would think he makes an announcement like this that he has a certain amount of credibility. What sort of talk does this announcement begin to generate among those who are watching the situation closely? What might he have been responding to?
Well, what's come out since then, and even the report that talked about Iran's possible links to this, that was circumstantial, basically saying that if you discount Hamas because they didn't claim it, Fatah didn't know what was going on till halfway into the crisis. It did leave a couple of groups with strong Iranian ties in northern Israel. The attackers came from a town that has supported an Iranian agent before. So it looks like there was some Iranian involvement there. That's all circumstantial. But then after he made that announcement on Sunday, just in the last day or two, there's been other stories that have come out proving that Iran did infiltrate the crisis with certain bits of Iranian, pro-Iranian propaganda. They were handing out those boxes of refreshments. It might not sound like much, but food, water, all boxes basically with Iranian flags on them saying that Jerusalem's ours. A quote from Ayatollah Khamenei that was found in Jerusalem, and we only get reports of that right now. But apparently the Palestinian Authority has come out and said that basically they were aware that Iran was trying to take advantage of the crisis, exacerbate it further, prove that it supports the Palestinian claim to the Temple Mount, that Iran is on the side of the Palestinian people. And that's possibly why you saw Fatah and the Palestinian Authority come on strong and say, we're canceling all, you know, ties with Israel. We're the ones leading this front against Israel, when really the Iranians might have been behind it. You had an article today or yesterday in the Times of Israel, and it was quoting senior Palestinian authority officials. So these are Mahmoud Abbas's group, and they're coming out and saying that they're angered by Iran's infiltration. And he said, they're saying it's a mistake to allow Iran's tentacles into the West Bank, into East Jerusalem. They believe that that has happened. Then they said that high up said, in the territory under Palestinian control, we would not let this happen, meaning the different areas that are under Fatah's control. We would not allow Iranians to a foothold like this, because this would come back around like a boomerang with the reactions of Arab states. So they're basically saying, hey, we knew about this. We didn't want to tell you for part of it because we had already canceled our ties with the security establishment. But just so you know, Iran was heavily involved at motivating those protesters. And maybe Netanyahu, there's been no official government statement about Iran's involvement yet. Yet the Palestinian leadership is coming out and saying Iran is involved in this Temple Mount impasse. They are stirring the pot. They want to be the champion of the Palestinian cause.
Quite an extraordinary development. Maybe you could just put this in context for us, because I'm just thinking back to the last several years, and we at the Trumpet we were talking a lot about Iran's designs on Jerusalem. Years ago, and obviously they have their Quds Force and they have their Quds Day every day, every year. And we did talk about the Ayatollah's speech, a few months ago, where he was talking about liberating Jerusalem and so on. But in terms of its sponsorship of terror within Israel, you know, the relationship between Iran and Hamas has been kind of rocky in recent years. It seemed like, very recently, maybe it's kind of gotten to warmer than it has been in recent years. But really, we're seeing this intensification of Iranian interest in Jerusalem and willingness to put blood in the game, willingness to put material online and to have more direct support. Are we not?
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. I mean, as you said, we have talked about Iran's desire for Jerusalem, Iran's desire to use Jerusalem as a unifying factor, or the quest for Jerusalem as the unifying factor, so it can gain allies throughout the Muslim world. Back in 1995, our editor-in-chief said that the most precious jewel in Iran's plan is to conquer Jerusalem. That sounds a little odd, honestly, just because if you look at the geopolitics of the region and its desire to squash Saudi Arabia, to push across the Middle East. But that's the truth. Their goal is actually Jerusalem. They really want Jerusalem. And it's been difficult to see how successful they're going to be at that, because you have the Palestinian Authority, it seems, in firm control of the Palestinians in the West Bank, or firmish control, and they're not allied with Iran at all. You have Hamas, they've been allied with Iran, and increasingly so, but they're in the Gaza Strip. So how are they going to get to Jerusalem? Palestinians can't come freely from the Gaza Strip over to Jerusalem. They can't do that. They're stuck in the Gaza Strip. So how would you motivate an Iranian-backed takeover of Jerusalem, or East Jerusalem, as we expect and said is going to happen? Well, you have to get in favor or on the side of the Palestinians in the West Bank. And these measures, again, they seem small as far as the actual support of protesters with food or water to make sure that they can keep on going. But that Iran has proven to win the hearts and minds of people throughout the past 30 years. That's how they started with Hezbollah. They started as a community force. It wasn't a fighting force. They're there with the social programs. That's how Iran infiltrates. And then it takes over. It adds a military component to it. And what we've seen over the past week and a half, it looks like, is Iran possibly starting to do that with the West Bank Palestinians.
Well, it is interesting when you have the Palestinian Authority essentially calling Iran out. And at this point, so you have this division between the Arabs that are living right there and this foreign, Persian influence that they're trying to hold at bay. And to think in terms of the coziness that Iran has had in the past with, as you mentioned, with Hamas and certain factions within the Palestinian population in Israel, still you have this something of what appears to be a holdout, and those who are wanting to make sure that they're maintaining leadership over the Palestinian cause at this point.
Yeah, but again, I mean, they are the Palestinian Authority is threatened by Iran. They're savvy to the way Iran works. I mean, even you look at how it started with the Houthis in Yemen, it seems a little bit out of the way, but the Houthis for the first 2 or 3 years of this revolt, as they were starting to fight against the government there, they didn't want to claim Iranian that they were just henchmen from Iran. They wanted to maintain the control over the leadership over their rebellion, but it just didn't work out that way because Iran, once they started to fund them, they paid them with the money, gave the money for their attacks. They ended up shipping armaments there, and nowadays the Houthis admit that they're a stooge of the Iranian regime. And again, you've seen that in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah. Hezbollah initially, they didn't necessarily want to. The Shiites in southern Lebanon didn't want to answer to Iran. Yet Iran's there helping out with cash and money. So eventually Iran takes control. Iraq didn't want to. The prime minister of Iraq does not want to be controlled by Iran. But Iran helped them out. Iran sent fighters in. Iran funded their military. And now Iran has taken over Iraq. Are they going to try and do the same thing with the Palestinians?
Well, excellent analysis. We appreciate that. We've been talking with Brent Noctegal, a trumpet writer in Jerusalem, about the violence on the Temple Mount. He has an article up on thetrumpet.com. It's from a few days ago. Palestinians are preparing for another intifada. I'm sure he's going to be writing up this latest information about what's happening with Iran infiltrating the situation. You can also listen to Stephen Fleury's Trumpet Daily Radio show from last week titled The Fight for the Temple Mount. This is real estate that we watch very, very closely because of its links to biblical prophecy and just how important it is in the flow of end time events according to biblical prophecy. So we're definitely going to keep our eyes trained on what's happening there. Brent, we appreciate you being right there on the front line, keeping us abreast of the latest developments. Thanks a lot for your time.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
How real is the threat of nuclear terrorism? A recent Washington Post report suggests that it's a whole lot more real than you want to believe. It was recently discovered that the Islamic State nearly stumbled into all the ingredients it would need for a nuclear bomb. To talk about this, we have from our Edmond office, trumpet writer Anthony Chibatadwe. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So tell us what happened here with the Islamic State that they came so close to gaining possession of this dangerous material.
The Islamic State has come close to a lot of things, as I'm sure a lot of people know by now. They came close to capturing a city. In fact, they did capture an entire city, the city of Mosul in Iraq, Iraq's second largest city. And they came so close to a lot of weaponry. They came so close to a lot of cash, a lot of gold. They took over all of those things. And there were many reports and many fears back at that time when the Islamic State captured Mosul that they were going to get hold of radioactive material. Radioactive material is all over the place in this world. Some of it is used for medical procedures, for cancer treatment. And there were fears that the Islamic State is going to get hold of that material and use it for terrorism. And they captured Mosul. They captured Mosul University. And that material was at Mosul University. So that's how close the Islamic State got to nuclear material. And for the 3 years that the Islamic State has been in Mosul, people have always felt that one of these days it's going to happen. One of these days they're going to detonate a dirty bomb, as it's called, because they don't have the capacity to actually make a nuclear bomb, as we understand a nuclear bomb. But they can put together that radioactive material and assemble what's called a dirty bomb that exposes a lot of radiation in the atmosphere and creates a lot of panic and chaos and health problems. So that's what everyone has been fearing this past 3 years. But thankfully, as the Washington Post reported, the Islamic State actually didn't do anything with the radioactive material. But that doesn't mean that it didn't come close to getting its hands on it. It just didn't get it. And analysts have speculated about the possible reasons why. But like you said, the threat of nuclear terrorism is very real. The Islamic State was so close to getting its hands on the material needed for it.
Okay, so you're talking about the threat of a dirty bomb. Obviously, this is a whole lot easier to assemble and to weaponize than, say, something on the scale of what you would expect in a nuclear bomb, and just the nuclear capacity, the refinement capacity that is required and so on. That's quite a complicated process. But how common are the ingredients needed? You're talking about, say, material that's used within cancer treatment wards. How common is this type of material? How much of it is there out there that could be used for that purpose if it got into the wrong hands?
The Washington Post article, it talks about how widespread it is. It is in every country, nearly every country. And in most modern nations, they're using more sophisticated machinery that makes it even more difficult for terrorists to get hold of that material. But in many second world nations, third world nations, that material is in abundance, and it's not that difficult for terrorists to get hold of it. So that's a big problem that we face.
So this was a near miss. You said they didn't actually make use of it, and there were people that they have various ideas as to why that would be the case. But how big is the danger that something like this could actually happen? The wrong people get hold of the kind of material that could be used in a weapon like this.
Let's just start with this case study of the Islamic State. The Washington Post received a report probably about a year ago, or maybe the beginning of this year. They heard information about how widespread nuclear material was in Iraq, and about how dangerous it could be. There was a group that did a study on the quantities of radioactive material that are in Iraq and try to figure out how much damage that would cause. And the Washington Post received information from that report, but they were asked by the United States government not to publish it only until Mosul was liberated. Because they knew that there were chances that anything could happen if the Islamic State realizes that, hey, we're sitting on, we have access to lethal material, we can create a lot of chaos. So this information has been out there. So you can say that this is a big problem, but a lot of people are trying to withhold some of that information because of how dangerous it is. Just that radioactive material, the problems that it might cause. The Washington Post was actually asked to withhold that information until Mosul was liberated because of the potential damage that can be caused, especially when groups like the Islamic State gets excited about, in their twisted way, gets excited about the potential damage that they could cause with just this material.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary. So the idea is that essentially ignorance is the thing that's preventing these groups from actually using this material. Now that the horse is out of the gate and this information is out there, that's no longer any kind of defense or solace. They would actually be able to use it now that they know what they're sitting on. Were they able to get a hold of it?
They were not, but But even within Iraq, there are still fears that they could get access to it. Islamic State, it has militants all over Iraq. And when that material was secured from Mosul University, the government kept it all secret as to where it was taken to. Nobody knows. Nobody knows where it was transported from. We know that it was at Mosul University. It was sitting there for all the time that Mosul was under occupation of the Islamic State. Now we don't know exactly where it is. And I think that's just significant in and of itself that everything is being kept under wraps because anything could go wrong.
You talked a little bit about just how dangerous a dirty bomb is, and because I guess it seems like the big issue here is the fact that it is so easy for groups that don't have any real technological prowess to be able to use that. Just in terms of the destructive power of a weapon that could be created from material that, say, came from, like you said, a radiotherapy machine or something like that. How many, what's the scale of destruction possible with that kind of a dirty bomb?
Well, probably the biggest problem that comes from detonating a bomb like this is just health problems. Well, first of all, there could be people who die in that kind of a bomb depending on the concentration of radioactive material within that bomb. Radioactive material tends to decay over time. So depending on how potent it is, there might be people that die directly from an explosion of it. But the main problem is just long-term health problems that come from exposure to radiation that might not kill people instantly, but over time, people could die from just the exposure to harmful radiation. This is radiation that's meant to kill cancer cells. And of course, in uncontrolled quantities, it can kill human beings over time. So that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is just panic, the widespread panic that will result from detonating a bomb like that. And if you think of war zones like Iraq, like Syria, if that happens in those places, there would be chaos. But even if it happens in Western societies, like say here in the United States, the disaster could be even worse because these are more crowded places, more sophisticated cities. Many articles gave the example of the Boston Marathon bombing a few years ago in 2013, where just two people with two pressure cookers, they didn't even have radioactive material, just pressure cookers that probably cost them $100 a piece. Mm-hmm. And they only killed two or three people, but they injured hundreds probably. And they caused $3 billion of damage in Boston or loss of business worth about $3 billion just from that. And if you imagine the what could happen if there was radioactive material being dispersed, then there will be more money being spent trying to clean up the radiation. Some buildings might have to be destroyed completely because of the contamination. So they are just long-term devastating problems that can come from just this kind of dirty bomb. And some people even say that, in a sense, it could be worse than just a nuclear bomb in that it's so easy. In fact, there have been some analysts who have just been surprised that more terrorists haven't been using these kinds of weapons. And I'm not talking about these are not people who glory in or who rejoice in terror and problems and destruction. No, these are government officials who are very pragmatic, very realistic about the problems that we face. And they said, I'm kind of surprised that Al-Qaeda hasn't been doing more of these kinds of attacks. They've been planning to hijack airplanes, you know, these spectacular attacks. When something like a simple pressure cooker, like what happened in Boston, or something like a dirty bomb could cause even as much destruction to society. So that's the problem that we face with nuclear terrorism. And the IAEA, it reports that every year, they receive hundreds of reports of theft of nuclear material. Now, like I said, some of that nuclear material, it decays over time, and some of it even harms the people who steal them. So that's a concern even for the terrorists. But if you're talking about terrorists like the Islamic State, who cares if they are exposed to nuclear radiation themselves? They don't care about that.
They have a suicidal approach to their attacks anyway.
Yes, there are some people who speculated that, well, maybe the reason why the Islamic State didn't use this radioactive material is that they feared that they could be exposed to the radiation themselves, but
doesn't quite make logical sense.
It doesn't.
Well, it's remarkable information, and it does really give pause. These analysts that you're talking about, these nuclear experts looking at this and saying, really, it's kind of remarkable that we haven't seen these kind of attacks yet. But looking at just how easy it would be to happen, how much material there is out there, how many malevolent actors there are who would be interested in perpetrating that kind of attack, we can't hold our breath and expect that this isn't going to happen sometime in the future. We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibodwe. He has an article on thetrumpet.com. The threat of nuclear terrorism is real. Go check it out. We appreciate your time, Anthony.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In just about any restaurant you go to, you're going to find the multicolored collection of sweetener packets. And if you love sugar, but you hate the side effects of sugar, this is the perfect food, right? The fastest growing sugar substitute right now on the market is sucralose, which is sold as Splenda. And this is said not just to make your food sweeter, but it's marketed as a way to lose weight. It's going to even help diabetics stay healthy. But like anything else in life, if it sounds too good to be true, you need to exercise some skepticism. To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, registered holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there.
So for the longest time, it seemed the biggest artificial sweetener was aspartame. But then that was shown to have some pretty serious problems. So now people are talking about Splenda, like this is the one with no negative side effects. What is this? What is Splenda exactly?
Sure. Splenda is a general sweetener that's found in almost all packaged products. It's found from baked goods to beverages, and it's stable at 450 degrees Fahrenheit, up to 450 degrees Fahrenheit. And because of this, it's a favorite sugar alternative in a lot of recipes. It's also touted as no calories. So the thing is, people are said to be able to use it and not gain weight with it. So if you're looking at this and saying, where is this product exactly? I don't think people have know anymore because it's hidden everywhere.
So it's being used so much in packaged foods, and it's on the market very broadly. You assume if it's on the market, it's been tested, it's safe. What is the safety record of this product, say, compared to something like aspartame?
Well, aspartame has shown to have a lot of problems, health problems so far. We've got the records of that. I mean, it's now discredited. And so this product, Splenda, has the backing of the EU Scientific Committee on Food, the World Health Organization, and the US Food and Drug Administration, and they're looking at about 110 safety studies over a 20-year period, which to them confirms the safety of sucralose. But however, the consumer skepticism remains high over the long-term safety, because our other artificial sweeteners, as we talked about, such as saccharin, cyclamates, and aspartame, they were also previously granted FDA approval, but they were later implicated as carcinogenic, toxic, or having minor side effects.
So we can't necessarily trust the science in a situation like this.
Well, that's the thing. There were also pre-approval studies done on Splenda, and Splenda was approved in 1998, but some pre-approval studies, which never made it among those 110, actually showed a range of adverse effects, ranging from liver and kidney damage, thymus gland and immune impairment, and even skin reactions. And despite these health effects, this study was dropped, and then there were only 6 human studies done. The rest were done on animals, and these studies were all 12 weeks or less. So here's Splenda approved for human consumption by national and international food safety regulatory bodies, with studies actually showing adverse effects.
Okay, so you mentioned a few of the adverse effects. What kind of effects are we talking about here?
Well, they're exhaustive. I mean, you can go into Medline and you can see a vast array of studies today, new studies. Now, given most of these studies are done with animals now, scientists do not want to work with humans on these. But having said that, one of the big ones was
they don't want to work with humans in the studies, but they're willing to market the product and put it in all of the baked goods and commercial products.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Animals are considered expendable, so they'll usually work with rats because rats really absorb the product much like humans. And then now, given that, most of the studies pre-approval were done on rats as well. And now the FDA is saying, well, the new studies today, we don't accept them because they're done on rats. So they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. So one of the big things about the Splenda is that it results in beneficial gut bacteria decreasing, and that's a big one. And the Canadian Society of Intestinal Research says scientists think the smoking gun in the cause of the global increase of irritable bowel syndrome, including all the symptoms and that are included with that, may be sucralose. So, and Canada once had the lowest rate of IBS in the world, but now is among the highest. Why? Since the approval of sucralose in thousands of products since 1991, there's a complete reversal. And if
so
we look
1991,
at,
I guess I wasn't aware of just how long this has been on the market. So these tests that you were talking about, the pre-approval tests, do those go back that far?
Yes, this was pre, I'm talking about the U.S. 1998, sucralose was approved in the U.S. The pre-approval studies were done before that, and they were dropped. So they never made it to the international bodies for study. Only the ones that were deemed favorable made it.
But we're talking about a product that's been on the market now for nearly 2 decades. And so, say, these studies that you were talking about, none of them tested beyond about 3 months. But now we're looking at the possible ramifications health-wise on our nations for having used a product over decades.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. I mean, it's not a small problem. People don't realize how big this problem is. We're looking at red blood cell counts being off, enlarged or calcified kidneys. We're looking at brain tumors, leukemia, lymphoma, higher mortality rates. I mean, sucralose is said to be an inert compound. It's said to go through the body and not store in a body, and that is absolutely not correct. It actually does store in a body, and some studies now show up to 40% of sucralose may be ingested, And that's quite contrary to all the studies since 1998 in the U.S.
I don't understand. 40% is ingested? 40% makes its way into your system?
It makes its way into your system. It's not supposed to make its way into your system. It's supposed to be excreted.
Yeah. So that's the aspect of it that is marketed, why it's such a valuable product, is that basically it makes the food sweet, but then it goes through your system without having any effects, and you eliminate it. You never actually internalize it, but the reality is that you do.
Right. So you can have your sugar, you can eat it unlimited, and you have all these adverse effects. Now, the problem with this product, it's a lot bigger than what I've even stated, because it's logical to ask why experts say there's a chlorine content in it. So when you make this product, you combine three atoms of chlorine to a sugar molecule. That's how you make Splenda. So it starts as a sugar molecule, and they add three chlorine atoms. Now, the experts say that's quite all right, because salt has chlorine. It's sodium chloride, and it's the same as salt. But that's not true. The truth is that the chemical form of chlorine in sucralose is the unsafe single atom form of chlorine, while table salt is simply a sodium chloride. So James Bowen, he's an MD, a physician and a biochemist, and he's an aspartame survivor. And he said sucralose is
just that. I have to draw attention to that term, an aspartame survivor. That gives you an idea of what we're talking about here, that these are not compounds to just have as a regular part of your diet.
Yeah, he got quite sick, and he's actually a medical doctor. This isn't just somebody on the street you meet and say, yeah, you know, this is just something I believe. This is a medical doctor, and he's also a biochemist, so he's no lightweight. And he said it's actually a chlorocarbon. Now, how he describes a chlorocarbon, he says it's nature's Doberman attack dog, a highly excitable, ferocious atomic element employed as a biocide in bleach, disinfectants, insecticides, and hydrochloric acid. I mean, you're basically injecting chlorine into your cells. That's what he says. Now, it's toxic to the body, and that's what we're finding out now.
So this substance that was marketed as being completely harmless, we have since put it in a tremendous number of our products, our processed foods. We're putting it on our tables, at our restaurants. People are consuming it in large quantities. And now we're finding the reality of the situation, that this is really quite harmful. It seems like this is kind of like this time bomb that we've placed within our food supply, and we're suffering all kinds of effects because of it.
That's absolutely correct. The general public has been duped, and there's a lot of money that goes into this, and these huge corporations pay a lot of money to get this stuff on the market, and you just wonder, how in the world do they get this on the market despite some of these studies showing these effects? Now, even the Japanese Food Sanitation Council, they argued, like, saying, look, as much as 40% of this stuff is absorbed, 40%, that means that's a lot of compound chlorocarbon that actually gets into the cellular structure. They said it's an exceptionally large amount, especially when we're dealing with a toxic substance. So the general public has no idea what they're doing when they open that little package. And I was watching somebody yesterday, I was in a restaurant. And it's quite clear is when you do study on this and you see people opening these little packages and they believe it's totally safe because it comes from government evidence.
Okay, so the person who says, okay, I get it, stay away from Splenda, how do they make sure that they keep this out of their diet? The person who's convinced that this is something they want to stay away from, you're talking about it being in a whole lot of products. What sort of ingredients are we looking for? on the ingredients list. How do we avoid it?
Well, the best way to avoid it is to avoid processed foods. I mean, that's just, if you're going to eat processed foods, it's going to be hidden in there. A lot of times you really have to watch. So if it's a low calorie product marketed towards people who want to lose weight, low sugar product, any of those, say a pop, if you drink pop, most of those will have Splenda in it. The real way to stay away from that is to stick with nutritionally complex sweets, natural foods, such as fruits or dates, figs, raisins. You could try coconut sugar, even grade B maple syrup, honey. Those are all natural sweeteners that will actually be nutritionally complex. See, our body's not made to withstand large amounts of sugar. And, you know, using chemical concoctions as replacements is simply not going to work. So we have to stick with what's natural and what's going to feed our body.
Yeah. Well, as always, we appreciate your insights and bringing this to our attention. We've been talking with registered holistic nutritionist York Mardian about Splenda and artificial sweeteners and the dangers that they pose. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that. Check it out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, York.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
The summer I turned 17 was somewhat of a low point in my relationship with my parents. It wasn't terrible, but it seemed we were arguing over more and more silly things. I thought they didn't trust me. They thought I was drifting away from them. But something happened that began to turn that relationship around. That summer, I spent 3 weeks in Orr, Minnesota at a summer educational program, SEP. It was a camp sponsored by my church. It was full of activities, sports, water skiing, a canoe trip, dorm life, dances, as well as instruction in Bible studies, fireside chats, fellowship with ministers. And I realized at that camp that I had not been honoring my parents as I should have been. I resolved that when I returned home, I would do my part to make the relationship better. I didn't realize it at the time, but this change in my attitude was actually fulfilling an Old Testament prophecy. In a letter he wrote in 1984, Herbert W. Armstrong, the man who founded the church I attended, the Worldwide Church of God, he wrote this: "Here in Australia, I have visited the SEP summer camp for youths 13 to 18 years of age. Words simply cannot describe the importance of these summer camps. These hundreds of young people will be adults being married and having children in just one decade. They are learning God's way of fun, and they're being taught God's truth. Their lives are being changed. These camps and the church YOU program for youths worldwide," and I'll talk about this in just a little bit, "they're turning the hearts of the children to their parents, and the parents to their children. And in this age when families are being broken up and youths are turning to alcohol, drugs, sex, and violence and becoming strangers to their parents, that is one of the vital things God is doing through his church as prophesied in Malachi 4 and verse 6. That's the prophecy I was talking about. And later in this letter, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "Not only are these summer camps of such supreme importance, but also our program of working with you parents so you may come closer to your children." He wrote this: "I call on you to have a closer relationship with your children. The last two verses of the Old Testament are a prophecy showing how important that is for you today." So this is what those verses say. Malachi 4, verses 5 to 6. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." Those words beautifully describe Mr. Armstrong's work. Over his 57-year ministry, he worked intensively to build families and turn hearts. The YOU program he mentioned was Youth Opportunities United. As a teen, I attended regular YOU sporting events, dances, talent showcases, fundraisers, and socials with my peers and my parents. In its publications, the church printed regular articles on marriage and family. They taught about dating, sex, childbirth, every aspect of every phase of parenting and child development, even grandparenting. Beginning in 1981, it began printing Youth Magazine for teens with frequent articles on building strong intergenerational relationships. Mr. Armstrong also founded three campuses of Ambassador College to teach true values to young people. Every effort was made to give graduating students the best possible foundation for happy, productive marriages and families. Ministers also offered counseling to couples considering marriage in order to help them build successful and enduring families. This was all specifically meant to fulfill Malachi's prophecy. It was a job Mr. Armstrong took very seriously. And at the heart of the issue was the deep biblical truth that we are preparing now to enter God's eternal family. That's why success in building our families today is so important. It gets us ready for our future. After Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, the Worldwide Church of God turned its back on this legacy of Bible-based family instruction. Within 4 years, though, the Philadelphia Church of God was founded. That's the church that sponsors this website and this radio broadcast. And right away, it resumed the work of turning the hearts of family members toward one another. We provide solid scriptural instruction on building strong families and many other topics in our magazines, The Trumpet, The Royal Vision, on our websites, thetrumpet.com and pcog.org. Our magazine, True Education, is for teens, and it helps young people navigate life and guides them toward closer relationships with their parents and with God. Ambassador College is now closed, but Herbert W. Armstrong College has filled the gap. Our ministers regularly provide marriage counseling and child-rearing help to our members, and we hold Philadelphia Youth Camp here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and in the Philippines and Australia. If we do our job right, we will help turn the hearts of those young people toward their fathers, just like mine was turned to my parents because of the work of Herbert W. Armstrong. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Brent Noctegal, Anthony Chabotterway, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Richard Palmer, Dwight Falk, and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you with this thought from Lawrence Johnston Peter. The only problems money can solve are money problems. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.